Time for Recollections. The National Broadcasting Company invites you to relax and reminisce with Recollections from the early days of radio. In this special series, we delve into the vast NBC library of sound to relive the memorable moments of radio's past, the stars who entertained you then, the special events that thrilled you. And to guide us through these priceless recollections, here is Ed Herlihy.
Thank you, Fred Collins, and good evening, everyone. Tonight, instead of recalling a variety of early radio stars, we're going to concentrate on the career of one man. A man who celebrates his 35th anniversary in radio. Yes, it was in 1922 that the Dean of American Newscasters and my good friend, H.V. Kaltenborn, did his first broadcast.
How did I ever get into broadcasting? Back in 1922, a freak invention called radio was exciting popular interest. The owners of the Brooklyn Daily Eagle, where I was an editor, thought radio might have possibilities. I was known for my gift of gab, and it was decided to make me the Brooklyn Eagle's radio voice. The mellifluous accents to which you are now listening did the rest.
That's how Mr. Kaltenborn once described his start as a newscaster and analyst. But it really wasn't as simple as all that. In an interview with Mary Margaret McBride several years ago, he remembered how he got his first newspaper job.
Well, you know, when I came back to New York in 1902 to get a job, it was very hard to get on any newspaper. And I tried various things to get on the Brooklyn Eagle, and none succeeded. And finally, I wrote a poem about Brooklyn Bridge, which began something like this. From the buildings that rise till they reach to the skies, from 20th floors and department stores, and so on, and told how the crowd at that time gathered at the entrance to Brooklyn Bridge and then fought its way across, because that was the great traffic jam of New York back in 1902. And by Jinx Gill Evans, the editor of the Brooklyn Eagle, the managing editor, he accepted it, and he called me in, and he said, "Kaltenborn, we don't usually pay for poetry on the Brooklyn Eagle, but you'll find $5 waiting for you down at the cashier's office." And he says, "I can't give you a job as a reporter, but if you'll come in next week, we'll give you a job at $8 a week as an office boy, and you can work on the Wall Street tables." Well, I said, "That's me." And that's how I got my start on the Brooklyn Eagle.
After that, you worked as a reporter, though, didn't you?
Yes, well, I received my advancement from $8 a week to a higher salary because I happened to be the only reporter on the Brooklyn Eagle, or the only man around there, because I wasn't a reporter, except for doing what we called night assignments. Of course, those we had to do free of charge. That was for the privilege of the education. See, after finishing my work as a Wall Street table man, at night, they gave me assignments, and I went out and reported such pleasant social gatherings as this one. Various whist parties they were in those days. And receptions and dances. Little social items that weren't too important so that I couldn't do anything that would have spoiled the reputation of the paper.
You could have got the initials wrong.
Well, that's how I learned. Then, suddenly, a count, the Count de Montesquieu de Fezensac, came to New York on a lecture tour, and I, as the only member of the Brooklyn Eagle staff who could speak French, was sent over to interview him. And the Count appreciated my linguistic ability, gave me a good interview. I wrote it up as best I could for the Eagle. It made the first page, and I was promoted from $8 a week to $12 a week and became a reporter. You know, I never used to say that that I was getting $12 a week. I simply said that, why, inside of my first 6 months on the Brooklyn Eagle, my salary was advanced 50%.
That's wonderful. That's really wonderful.
And as Mr. Kaltenborn continued reminiscing about his early career, he detailed the events that led up to that first broadcast, April the 4th, 1922.
I was giving a series of current events talks in the auditorium of the Brooklyn Daily Eagle. They came once a week. The auditorium was always filled. We always had to turn people away, because at that time, it was in the beginning of the First World War, people were tremendously interested in current events. And so we began in that way, and they built up to a climax of interest. Then along in the early 20s came radio, and we realized that we could get a much larger audience instead of 500 people, which was all the Eagle Auditorium held. We could have as many as 50,000 if I'd go on the air. Well, that seemed tremendous, multiplying it by 50 or 100. And so we decided we'd put the programs on the air. My very first broadcast, as it happened, was made from Bedloe's Island, just behind the Statue of Liberty. There, the Signal Corps had established an experimental long-wave station, and I went there and talked for 30 minutes on current events.
Mm-hmm.
That was the first time that current events were analyzed on the radio, so that was one of the several firsts which I was fortunate enough to accomplish.
And that was H.P.'s recollections of his first radio broadcast 35 years ago. Many notable milestones have since highlighted his years of radio reporting. He was one of the first to broadcast news from overseas when he covered the Spanish Civil War. In 1938, during the crucial days of the Munich crisis, he chalked up a broadcasting record that's never been equaled. 102 times in 18 days, he went on the air to interpret the fast-moving events in Europe. And this is how he remembered that marathon when Mary Margaret McBride interviewed him.
I was on the air practically all the time, night and day. They'd wake me up, a bulletin would come in, and I'd go on the air half asleep and analyze it.
It was going on all day long, interrupting every program, I guess.
Yes, constantly, because the interest of the United States reached a high point then that it has never reached except during very brief periods during the Second World War. For example, when we were expecting the peace with Japan, peace with Germany. Those highlight moments, of course, there was equal listener interest. But outside of that, I think the Munich crisis was really a top listening period for American radio.
I was also reading last night the account that you got from London at that time of when Chamberlain came back for the second time, how he was met by cheering crowds and everybody thought peace in our time, and there was talk of a knighthood for him. Do you remember all that?
Oh, yes. He was, of course, the great hero for the moment, because he had returned, and the British people, who knew they were not prepared for war, were gratified beyond all else that, for the moment at least, war had been avoided.
And in France, the same thing was happening.
And I remember I went on the air, and I said, "Today they ring the bells, tomorrow they may wring their hands." And that turned out to be very true, because I knew enough about Hitler and dictators in general to realize that every concession you make to them merely creates another demand. And that, by the way, is the lesson of history that we must bear in mind today, that there is a dictator government which is powerful and which is expanding and which is imperialist and which is aggressive, as our State Department has said. And such a government must be met with firmness, not with concessions, with directness, not with appeasement.
What thing did any man ever say to you that stands out right now in letters of red in your mind? Would it be Wilkie? Would it be Roosevelt? Would it be Hitler? Would it be Mussolini? All these you've interviewed? Or would it be some other one person?
Well, as you mention those names, a phrase flashed into my mind from Hitler's angry when I defended the Jews of Germany. "You are wrong." He just roared it at me. And it made quite an impression because I knew that I was right and that he was wrong. And I said to myself at the time, "Well, I can't answer you now, but the world will answer you."
Mm-hmm.
And it did.
In every major world crisis the world has gone through during these past 35 years, H.V. Kaltenborn has been ready to report the details and interpret them for us. That was December the 7th, 1941.
Here is what has happened. President Roosevelt phoned Secretary Early half an hour ago that the Japanese had attacked Pearl Harbor, the United States naval base on Oahu Island in the Hawaiian Islands. A few minutes later, he again phoned Mr. Early and told him that planes had attacked Manila. This means that war is underway between Japan and the United States.
It was April the 12th, 1945.
Good afternoon, everybody. The President of the United States died
at 3:35 p.m. this afternoon in the Warm Springs environment that he loved so much. He dies at the end of an era. Few men have lived through so much. Few men have been privileged to lead their country under conditions of such tremendous difficulty and with such great success. For it was Franklin D. Roosevelt who led us from depression to recovery, who led us from war to what is now almost peace. And so it is true that as he led us from depression to recovery, it was given to him to lead us into war, yes, and against his will, then through war to victory, but not yet to final peace.
And there were the elections of 1948, Truman and Dewey. You recall that H.V. was among the many who were wrong about the outcome and thereby received some good-natured presidential ribbing? Remember that election night when Truman jumped into the lead and H.V. figured it didn't mean a thing? Well, he was confident that his own figures were right, and he went right on predicting a victory for Dewey.
Summing up all the figures that I have had, which I have managed to compare with those of 4 years ago, indicate a gain of anywhere from 2, 3, 4, 5, up to 10% for Dewey. I am inclined to think that while it is a very close race on the basis of the figures as they now stand on our board, Dewey has the best chance.
And that led to the famous Truman imitation of H.V. Kaltenbrunner, January the 19th, 1949, at the Electoral College dinner.
And Mr. Kaltenbrunner was saying, well, the president is a million votes ahead in the popular vote we have yet to hear. That when the country vote comes in, Mr. Truman will be defeated by an overwhelming majority.
And H.V. reported the Truman lampoon the following day.
Last night, President Truman, in light-hearted mood, gave his Electoral College hosts a side-splitting imitation of radio commentator H.V. Kaltenbrunner making wrong predictions on election night. In doing that, and in the genial way in which he did it, he proved once again that for the next 4 years, we can all be human with Truman. Beware that man in place of power who has no sense of humor.
Here's another facet of the Kaltenbrunner personality. His ability to deliver a comedy line with the finesse and timing of the best laugh makers. Witness this occasion with Eddie Cantor, who was sponsored at that time by a well-known toothpaste.
Every time you broadcast, I sit with my ear glued to the radio.
Thank you, Eddie. Every time you broadcast, I sit with my ear glued to the radio.
Oh, thank you.
One of these days, I'm going to turn it on.
Thank you. You know, H.V., I've heard all of your broadcasts, and those days during the last international crisis must have been pretty hectic for you.
Yes, Eddie. Sometimes I'd broadcast 24 hours a day. Gosh. In the morning, I'd send out for orange juice, and after brushing my teeth, I would...
Wait a minute, H.V. What do you brush your teeth with?
A toothbrush.
Yes. Well, I knew you didn't use a whisk broom, but what do you put on the toothbrush?
My teeth.
Look, H.V., you use toothpaste, don't you?
Why, yes, of course.
What kind of paste?
The very best kind.
Yeah?
Comes out of a tube.
But there's something written on the tube. What is it? What does it say?
Squeeze this end.
A great deal of your success is due to your distinctive style. In fact, there's only one criticism I can make. Most of the time when you're on the air, you sound optimistic and cheerful, but sometimes you sound a little depressed, and once in a while, your program is very sad.
Well, sometimes the news makes my program sound sad.
Mm-hmm.
What's your excuse, Eddie?
That's a funny thing, you know. Up to now, I never hit a man with glasses. But let's stick with the commentators, H.V. Which one of the commentators is your favorite?
Well, of course, H.V. I like Walter Winchell.
Oh, sure.
That fellow really gets some inside stories.
Oh, that's true.
But I can talk fast, too.
Well, H.V., it isn't only speed that counts. It's the sheer force of one's personality, the quality of the voice. Why, a man is sure of success when he can approach the microphone with unwavering confidence and say...
How do you do?
Russian, I want to tell you, this man is Kaltenborn.
Is he doing anything for that?
No. Well, H.V., what do you think of him?
Eddie, this man is the worst catastrophe I have ever witnessed.
Yes, a delightful sidelight on H.V. Kaltenborn from our Library of Sound as we continue this salute to his 35th anniversary in radio. Mr. Kaltenborn has always traveled widely to keep in touch with world events, and his interviews with dictators and statesmen the world over have resulted in many vivid broadcasts. This one, for instance, date January 30th, 1948.
One of the world's great leaders is dead. The fanatical assassin's bullet has ended the selfless career of the man who did most to bring political freedom to 400 million Indians. Mohandas K. Gandhi died a martyr to the cause for which he lived. Because he preached peace, he was killed by a misguided fellow Hindu who believed in force. The man who lived for nonviolence died by violence. My interview with the 78-year-old Mahatma was one of the highlights of my recent round-the-world flight. I had to choose between seeing Lord Mountbatten and Indian leader Nehru in New Delhi or hurry to Calcutta to see Gandhi. I chose to see Gandhi, and was one of the last American reporters to talk with him. He was then in Calcutta to restore peace between Muslim and Hindu. In Calcutta each day for more than a year, they had witnessed fratricidal murder. The moment Gandhi arrived, there was peace. When I saw him, the villa he occupied in the Muslim area of Calcutta was surrounded by a huge crowd of fanatical followers. Muslims and Hindus mingled freely in the crowd. They forgot their age-old feud to honor Gandhi. Again and again, they cried out, demanding that he show himself. Weakened by his recent fast, Gandhi was lying on a mat covered with white cloth in one of the bare rooms of the old villa. He was surrounded there by his secretaries and a few intimates. His granddaughter, who looked after his personal wants, was applying hot, wet cloths to his fragile body. He excused himself for not rising and asked us to sit near him on the floor so that we might hear one another speak above the roar of the crowd. To look at him was to marvel that from this frail bit of humanity there could radiate a spiritual force that encompassed the world. His head was bald. He had so few teeth I wondered at his perfect enunciation. His English was distinguished, yet he seemed the living embodiment of famine and poverty. It was hard to believe that this wizened, almost helpless human being was radiating a greater personal influence than any living man, that this was the man who had changed the face of India's destiny. The room in which we were was ugly and bare. I began the interview by congratulating him on India's freedom, which was being celebrated that very day by delirious crowds roaming and driving through Calcutta's streets. The Mahatma shook his head sadly. "Our work has just begun," he said. "I did not want this division of India. This is not the free, united India for which I struggled. Freedom has come, but not as I asked to have it come. The division of India creates so many problems, but we must find a way of solving them. The happiest thing at this moment is that there is no more fighting here between Hindu and Muslim." This was true. The day Gandhi arrived in Calcutta on his mission of reconciliation, the daily assassinations ceased, and the two religious communities once more mingled peacefully. By this time, the clamor of the impatient crowd had grown so loud that Gandhi decided he must show himself once more. His granddaughter removed the cloths from his body. Assisted by a secretary, she helped him to his feet. Slowly, with painful steps, He made his way to the window. The outside clamor increased. He asked for quiet, but no one heard him. Then, when he put his fingers to his ears to close out the noise, they understood and suddenly were silent. "Be at peace," he said in a weak voice. "Please be quiet and let me rest. Go to your homes and let each one of you work for Hindu-Muslim unity. Let that be your prayer as it is mine." Those nearest the window understood. The rest renewed their clamor. After Gandhi was back on his couch, we saw that the effort had tired him and took our leave. Gandhi was a strange mixture of spirituality and shrewdness in his unselfish personal and political leadership. If he had not had political genius as well as spiritual insight, he could never have become the great leader of his people. He was indeed India's great soul as well as her great emancipator. In a moment of frank self-revelation, Gandhi once said to a British official from whom I have the story, "My Indian people regard me as a saint who is trying to be a politician, but I regard myself as a politician who is trying to be a saint." Politician or saint, Gandhi has within himself the qualities of true greatness and of true moral grandeur. Few men have combined so much mind with so much heart. In our time, we shall not look upon his like again. May he rest in that peace he died to win. Yes, a great soul has gone to rest. A great man has died. India will cherish his memory for centuries to come.
A finely etched tribute to Gandhi, typical of H.V. Kaltenborn's personal reporting. Through his eyes, we are always able to see events more clearly. And this is because Mr. Kaltenborn insists that analysis is an integral part of news reporting. The meaning of the news, the background of the news, he says, is more important than the news itself.
Well, an analyst has the task of trying to place foreign events in proper perspective and to show the average listener of how it affects him. Mm-hmm. And of course, that's the great lesson we want to bring home to our American people, that whatever goes on in the world, anywhere, everywhere, is of direct and immediate concern to the average American, even though he lives in a little Wisconsin village.
And in every village and town, the name H.V. Kaltenborn has become synonymous with news analysis. So much so that cartoonists have had some sly fun with this fact. Mary Margaret McBride mentioned it while interviewing H.V. some years ago.
I had this piece of literature that had these cartoons. You know, I enjoyed so much Ted Key's cartoon, Hazel. Remember,
oh, yes.
Hazel? I've forgotten just what she said, but she has the radio turned on, and there you are, and she's going to hush everybody, no matter who
yes.
they are. Time for H.V. Kaltenborn.
You know what I've done? I wrote to her for the original of that cartoon. It actually is this. Hazel, in a tremendous spirit of excitement, there's some women sitting around a bridge table, and they're jabbering away. She raises a very militant arm and says, "Silence! H.V. Kaltenborn is on the air." So she sent me the original, and I've now got that. My wife insisted on putting it on the door of my study. So anybody that comes to the study...
He talks about Hazel as if she's a real person. Ted Key is Hazel's creator. And then some more of these cartoons tickle me. Here's a ship going down, and the men are being put out in the lifeboat, and I guess this is the commander, is it up
no, it's
there?
I think it's the radio operator.
The radio operator says, "Hold on, men. I've got H.V. Kaltenborn on the radio. He's analyzing our predicament." And then here are two men. And they've got a little radio out here in the jungle. And one says, "Hey, here's Kaltenborn. He'll know the name of the place we've captured." You know, when you get to be the subject of cartoons, you're a household word, and that's fame, brother. That's fame.
Yes, Mary Margaret, I must agree with you. That's fame. Our recollections of H.V.'s long career would hardly be complete without one more viewpoint, that of one of the new generation of commentators. Chet Huntley, you fall into that category. What are your recollections as you look back over Mr. Kaltenborn's 35 years in radio?
I suppose there are very few Americans of my generation who can recall precisely the first time they heard H.V. Kaltenborn. But somehow he'll always be associated with that awareness which overtook us in the latter half of the 30s. It was a young generation which had somehow managed to work itself out of the Depression, with many of the old easy beliefs and convictions we might otherwise have had pretty well shaken. Then came the speeches of Hitler, with H.V. Kaltenborn translating them and analyzing them at the conclusion. That generation listened, and it somehow got the implication. These were not just the running translations and evaluations of speeches by some odd-looking, odd-behaving leader of a foreign country, which was very far away and about which we knew very little. We listened, and we knew the things Hitler was talking about might have a profound effect on our lives. It was H.V. Kaltenborn who said to us, perhaps not in so many words, but by implication at least, who said to us, "Look, this is important. You had best listen, and you had best think." Well, that generation did a lot of thinking before it was all over, and it did some bleeding, too. There were few illusions in the minds of the men who fought. And why do you suppose it was that when it was all over, in spite of the spirit of accomplishment, of victory, in spite of the accumulated market for peacetime pursuits and luxuries, this nation turned to its worldwide post-war responsibilities as no other nation has ever done? I think it was because Americans understood the problems and knew the calculated risks. H.V. Kaltenborn was the prototype of a whole new profession, the radio news analyst or commentator. They opened up and explored a whole vast and new area of communication. Their total audiences over the years would be measured in billions. Now, this is not to suggest, nor would H.V. suggest it, that he or any one of us was or is eternally and everlastingly endowed only with profound wisdom and fundamental truth and shining accuracy. Few of us in this profession agree with each other on anything, so how could an audience always agree? But this much is certain, H.V. Kaltenborn started something, a something which has never been finally nor completely defined, but which I might suggest was a new, convenient, and powerful means of eliciting or provoking some thought. There are millions of Americans, H.V., who would say thank you on this, your 35th anniversary in this profession. None of those thank yous is more profound nor earnest than that which comes from all of us who came after you in this wonderful business. You set the pace, and most of the ground rules devised and written by you are still in the book.
Thanks, Chet Huntley. And I'm sure our listeners join in thanking Mr. Kaltenborn for the great contributions he has made to broadcasting and in wishing him a very happy 35th anniversary. Next week, on Recollections, I've planned a variety of treats for you. You'll hear Shirley Temple as she sang at the height of her fame. You'll hear Marian Anderson's very first network appearance, just as it happened 21 years ago. And many more priceless excerpts from our NBC Library of Sound. Good night, everyone.
Ed Herlihy has been your host on Recollections. Join him next week at this time for more highlights in the history of radio broadcasting. This is Fred Collins. Recollections is an NBC Radio Network production directed by Bob Maurer.
Recollections of 30 is another worldwide presentation of the United States Armed Forces Radio and Television Service.